Alrighty, boys and goyles. Give it to Garrett. Alright, so all of your exams are graded, except for the one individual who did not take the test that will contact me with haste in order to schedule an appointment when he can take the test, or she. And as soon as that individual takes the exam, I'll open it up so you can see how you did. But I will just say, I was very pleased. So thank you for the effort that you put into it, and hopefully we can repeat. I will warn you, and this is a trend that I've seen teaching this class over the last 5 or 6 years, exam one, because the stuff is the hardest and I make the exam the easiest, students have a tendency to overperform. So don't get cocky. They are going to get a little more challenging. So just make sure you can continue with the hard work. Yes?
So I got, like, out of one question, my computer glitched and it skipped the question. So I lost, 3 points automatically.
Oh, no.
It is oh, no. Oh, no. That's a lot of points.
Whoa. You did okay.
I did?
Yeah, you did. Everyone, pretty much everyone did okay. What?
Did we get that extra credit for the video?
I did not check the analytics. YouTube doesn't let me check it for 48 hours. So when I get home tonight, I'm going to check it. Yes?
Professor, the extra credits, does it have a final date to be submitted?
The extra credit for exam one, we're passed. It was due on Monday, like I said.
Really? So I didn't see that.
I said it in class.
What?
The extra credit.
Was that both essays?
No. The section review questions in the reader.
Professor, give us this. I didn't see it.
No. I said Monday.
Who is in class for extra 1 week?
No, and we're not doing no democracy. Look at that. Oh, my God. Look at that. You're overwhelming you against you. Wow. That's called a landslide of opposition. So you can begin. You can begin the extra credit for.
Extra credit is going to be awesome.
Rama, you can begin the extra credit for exam two today, and that will be due on the day that we have the second exam.
Yes, I did say that, trust me.
I said it, yes.
Was the other essay, because I thought, I must have misunderstood you.
No, there was an extra credit question on the exam, but we're talking extra credit.
Okay, so one of the essays we had to do, and the other essay we could have skipped, correct?
If you wanted to, yes. Okay. So if you skipped it, the most you could have gotten is 100. If you tackled it, the most you could have gotten is 110.
Okay.
The extra
credit,
I'm talking about,
you want
that is
part of the media. I mean, it's just.
All right. So, like I said, as soon as the individual who did not take the test sends me an email, I will open it up. Hopefully, it's sooner than later. All right. Also, how many of you watched the video on Tuesday, like you're supposed to? Oh, man, this class might actually, there's enough people. We might be there. Right there. I'll check it. Fingers crossed. So you know exactly where we're going to pick up. So we're starting a renaissance, and we're laying the foundation for the conditions that were in Italy that would allow the renaissance to take place. Because, I don't know if I mentioned it, but I'll mention it now because it's on the top of my head. The thing about intellectual movements or literary movements or artistic movements, they don't happen when times are bad, right? Who has time to paint or sculpt or read a book when there's war, plague, devastation? One of the things that allowed the Renaissance to take root in Italy, I think I did mention, was the fact that because of their economies, because of their involvement in the Mediterranean trade, they were able to rebound quicker. So things in Italy, yes, they suffered death in the Black Plague, but there was no Hundred Years' War. There was no Mongolian invasion. So pretty much once the plague subsided, money was just pouring in. And to give you a comparison, think the United States after both World War I and World War II. If it wasn't for the World Wars, we would have never become a global superpower. But it was all the money that was coming in the United States that allowed our standard of living, which you all have known nothing other than.
Unless, of course, you came from another country.
So, if anything catastrophic happens in the United States, there's going to be no time to go to school or watch TikTok videos or
write love poetry or write songs, because people are going to be in a struggle for survival.
So, I'm not saying there were dumb people elsewhere in the world, but Italy was just kind of isolated, and they got lucky. And that's one of the reasons why the Renaissance began. Why was there no wars? Well, we're going to start right now. We've already covered the five major states. Well, going back to the 13th century, all the way up to the 15th century, so we're talking the 1200s, 1300s, 1400s, the Italian city-states kind of cooperated in focusing on peace and safety. So they didn't fight against one another. They did business with one another, but they collectively tried keeping the outside powers out of Italy. They didn't want the French coming in, or the Spaniards, or the Germans. So they were united, and that's what allowed that bubble to be created. But there's probably, if you're politically oriented, we're going to be one of those interesting little subsections. But with the dawn of the 16th century, going into the 1500s, that cooperation changed for a brief period of time. And it's when the cooperation changed that marked kind of the end of the Italian Renaissance, because the problems of the continent poured into Italy. Kept outsiders away. All right. In 1494, one of the most action-packed periods of political events began in Italy and would last for two decades, creating what historians refer to as the School of Europe. And I'm not being sarcastic, action-packed. Every possible major geopolitical factor that plagues the world today took root in Italy, except for nuclear proliferation, in two decades. And it began when a pope intervened with politics. In 1494, the Kingdom of Naples was angry with the Duchy of Milan over the fact that the duchy was not cooperating and playing by the rules. In other words, politics. One of the biggest things, the Duke of Milan, Ludovico il Moro, increased the tolls that the church had to pay when all of the money was coming through those passes that I talked about. So as a consequence, the Pope, Alexander VI, convinced the Kingdom of Naples, which was the largest country, and Florence, which of course was the bankers of Italy, to go to war with the Duchy of Milan. So that way, the rates could be lowered. Again, like the details that I gave you with the Crusades, we don't have to remember it in that specificity. I'm just kind of explaining. For hundreds of years, regardless of what was going on, the attitude was, Italy is going to deal with Italian problems. But in response to the threat of the largest army that was well-funded with the blessing of the Pope, The Duke of Milan, Ludovico il Moro, did something that had never been done before. He reached out to France, and he would make an alliance with Charles VIII. Charles VIII, of course, was the French king that brought an end to the Hundred Years' War. But of course, by this point, he was old. But nonetheless, Ludovico contacts Charles and essentially reminds Charles, hey, you know, you have family connections. You have blood with the king of Naples. And that if you were to go down, attack Naples, it would be your right because of blood. In fact, Ludovico claimed that Charles's claim to the Napoleon throne was actually better than the current occupant. So, of course, we know how kings think. Kings scratch their heads and say, more, more, more. If they can get more land, they can make more money, which would allow them to become more powerful. So what does Charles do? Simple. He sends an army, 25,000 strong. They march through the Alps. They're given free access through Milan. I gotta go back to my Italian peninsula. They march through Modena, invade Florence, and the Florentines quickly surrendered because they didn't want to have all their money taken. The French army continues south, blasts through the Papal States, and invade the Kingdom of Naples. Terrified, the king, Alfonso II, flees. And Charles crowns himself King of Naples. Now suddenly, he is in Italian politics. But here's the thing. They opened up Pandora's box. All of the Italian states were terrified by how easily the French rolled over everyone. Because don't forget, the French had been practicing in war. All of the advancements, technology that the French army had made during the Hundred Years' War, including using cannon, they used in their invasion, and they literally blew everyone away. So suddenly all of the other leaders in all of the other Italian states started saying, we're next. It's possible that Charles, with his army, could basically conquer all of Italy. So what happens? Politics. The Italian states do an enemy of my enemy is my friend. Led by Venice, or the Republic of St. Mark's, the Papal States, Florence, and even Ludovico decide that the French threat was more than any Italian threat. So they form what became known as the Venice League, and the combined forces drive the French out. Of course, Charles marched all the way back up the peninsula, laying waste to much of Italy. But the threat was over. And it was a powerful lesson. Don't invite outsiders in. Questions so far? All right. Well, this created a state of chaos. The Italians realized that if the French come in, or God forbid the Germans come in, or even the Spaniards, that Italy, unless they unify, does not have the strength to keep these foreigners out. So they began engaging in diplomacy. They began making terms. And everything was going well until the Pope saw an opportunity for personal familial gain. Now, FYI, any of you see, I think it was on Showtime, might have been HBO, I don't remember. But there was a movie series called The Borgias. The Borgias, anyone know that family, The Borgias? Well, Pope Alexander was a Borgia. And he was a former cardinal of Spain who, because of the Babylonian captivity, bought his position. So he entered the church not because of devotion, because he had wealth. And he played politics to get himself the position of Pope. But historians regard him as the most corrupt Pope in history. He actually had 3 children, which he acknowledged. One of which, Caesar, for a while he actually made him cardinal. But the Pope decides to use the chaos. Everyone's focused on the French threat for an opportunity. He would use the Pope, go back. He would. He would use the papal money to give his son an army. Bless you.
Thank you.
And his son would conquer the province of Romagna. Where are we going? Go back. This state right here. And he would make himself a despot. So this would become private lands. So again, church money, hired mercenaries for personal gain. Well, Alexander realizes that if he makes this move, the Venetian League, which now he's betraying, will attack him. So what does he decide to do? Well, Alexander reaches out to the new king of France, Charles VIII died heirless, but Louis XII was his cousin. So the closest blood relative, they made him the king of France. So, he does the same thing that Ludovico did with Charles. The Pope contacts the French king and said, hey, look, Naples should be yours. If you come in and invade Italy, I will bless your invasion and you can take Naples. Essentially creating a distraction. Look, everyone's going to pay attention to the French invasion. Everyone's going to pay attention to the French invasion. But no one's paying attention to what Cesare's doing. Perfect. Perfect politics. Well, long story short, once the king received word, of course he wants to take Naples because, like his dead cousin, he felt it was his birthright. So he invades Naples, Milan rather. He invades Milan and marches all the way down to Naples. The league is shattered. They can't stop the French king. And in and around the time Louis' forces get to around Rome, that's when Caesar's army moves and conquers Romagna. Well, simultaneously, not that we need to remember this, but the Pope, because he was a Spanish cardinal, had also talked to none other than Ferdinand of Aragon, as in Ferdinand and Isabella, the king and queen that blessed Columbus. He said to Ferdinand, you can take Sicily. To which Ferdinand agreed. So the Spanish take half of the kingdom of Naples, and the French take the rest. And of course, in the chaos, the Pope gets territory for his son. It's all good. All good. Chaos and devastation and fear swept Italy for 3 years. But death changed the dynamic. In 1503, Alexander dies. And his successor, Julius II, despised Alexander and despised his corrupt, vile family. So out of the blue, Julius changes the political system. So new guy in office, new politics. He excommunicated Caesar. He declared that Romagna would be part of the Papal States, not privately owned. And then changes sides. He goes against the French. He formed what became known as the Holy League. Venice joined the Pope, but Julius also contacted the enemies of Louis on the continent. They conquered the Spanish. And they contacted the Holy Roman Empire. So now, the Papal States, the Venetians, the Spanish, and the French, the Spanish and the Germans, are in an alliance against the French. Well, because France is surrounded geographically on two sides, the king quickly abandons Naples. Like Charles, he marches north, lays waste to a good chunk of the continent, blasts through Milan, gets back to France to hold off a Spanish and a German invasion. But unfortunately, Louis died shortly thereafter. And the French throne passed to his son-in-law, Francis I, who was outraged of the betrayal of Julius. So, he builds another French army, once again blast through Milan, quickly defeated a Papal States army, claimed Milan for himself, and contemplated marching south. But the new Pope, because Julius had also died, Leo X, basically agrees to buy Francis off. In order to avoid another sweeping French army going down the peninsula, laying waste to everything, in an agreement, Leo gave to Francis the state of Milan. And allowed him to tax the church money coming through Milan. This agreement was known as the Concordat of Bologna. Francis keeps Milan and can tax the church. So all of this started in Italy. because of politics. But this craziness, betrayals, alliances, secret agreements. Ooh. Would also result in continental war. For the next, that was a good catch. For the next 40 years, the family that controlled Germany and Spain, the Habsburgs, battled against the family of Francis, the Valois. Starting 4 decades of European wars. All of which the French would lose, which I kind of get a chuckle out of. So why do I mention this? Well, like I said, the Renaissance began in Italy because there was peace, because the economy was strong. But the Renaissance would eventually move out of Italy and would end up in Northern Europe. Because Italy became violent, destructive. And the great works began to diminish. But this period of 2 decades would become the template that historians and politicians and diplomats would study all the way up until the 20th century. If you wanted to go to university from 1500 all the way up to like 1920, well, probably World War I. I think World War I pretty much knocked it off the books. But for 400 years, if you went to university in Europe, you learned about this period. You learned about it in detail. Because like I said, everything was there. Manipulation, politics, alliances, betrayals, assassinations. It was all there. But the funny thing is, if you ever have an opportunity to dig down, you can see the crap that's going on in the world today. Proxy wars, secret treaties, betrayals. It still happens. But of course, because the population is bigger and technology is more significant, the consequences are more severe. But here we go. From violence comes inspiration. The power politics, and that's what it's referred to, power politics that were on display would be studied and mastered. But the lessons would be recorded and published by a writer and be recorded for posterity. Have any of you ever read Niccolò Machiavelli's The Prince? No? I don't teach that anymore? Christ, I had to read The Prince. I think I was in like 8th or 9th grade. Machiavelli was a diplomat. He lived in Florence. And he himself, in the chaos, particularly towards the end, with the arrival of Julius and eventual rise of Leo, he found himself out of a job. He was actually exiled from Florence for a while. But in 1513, he would write a book called The Prince as a way to beg the Medici to allow him to come home. This book was dedicated to the Medici rulers of Florence. And in it, it's a very short book, but it shows the mindset of leaders, rulers. And by the way, politicians today still practice what is referred to as Machiavellian politics.
If you do the extra credit, Rama, for the second exam, and you read the excerpt of the prince, what you will see in the text is that Machiavelli had a very low opinion of humanity. To put it directly, Machiavelli essentially states that, well, basically people suck. In his words, people are, and I quote, ungrateful. They are changeable. They are simulators and dissimulators. They run away in danger, but they're eager for gain. They do well by you when they are yours. They offer you their blood, their property, their lives, their children, when the need's far off. But when it comes close, they turn about and abandon you. Spot on. Spot on. Do you ever have a friend that promises you the world, but then the time you need them, they're nowhere around? Machiavelli is warning leaders, you can't trust the people. Because the people only want things for you. By the way, why do you think politicians, when they run for office, all they do is promise people stuff, other people's money? They promise socialist redistribution. They promise housing. Look at what Biden did in 2020. Free tuition. That never happened. Politicians lie, but they promise you the world because they're trying to win you over. Because politicians know if they told you the truth, you'd abandon them. So they gotta lie to you. And by the way, it's not just a Democrat thing. Republicans lie as well. Politicians are awful. Why? Well, human beings suck. So, given that people are awful, how can you actually lead? Well, in The Prince, Machiavelli lays out that the leader must be able to handle human nature. A leader must be at all times both a fox and a lion. To quote The Prince, a prince is necessitated to play the animal well. He chooses among the beasts the fox and the lion. Because the lion does not protect himself from the traps, the fox does not protect himself from the wolves. The prince must be a fox, therefore, to recognize the traps, and a lion to frighten the wolves. You must be clever and you must be fierce. Why? Well, I'm going to continue with the quote. By no means can a prudent ruler keep his word, and he does not when to keep it works against himself. And when the reasons that made him promise are annulled, if all men were good, this maxim would not be good. But because they are bad and do not keep their promises to you, you likewise do not have to keep your promises to them. So, politicians lie to you because they know you, as a voter, next election, could easily turn around and vote for somebody else. So in order for them to stay in office, they don't care about you, but they claim they do.
One of the best political lines came from former President Bill Clinton. Bill Clinton was trained by Hollywood actors to cry on demand. You know, there are actually actors and actresses that have the ability. They can tear up and start crying on demand. There are others that they have to, you know, stop the scene and they put like lemon juice or something to get people to tear up. And then they film it. But Bill Clinton learned how to do it. And whenever something bad happened, he'd get on TV with that slight southern drawl that he spoke in. Coming across as very simple, plain, cordial. And he'd look into the camera and say, "America, I feel your pain."
Powerful. It's one of the reasons why, despite the fact that former President Clinton, who like did very bad things, sexually assaulted women, screwed elderly people out of their life savings, before he became office and afterwards, people still love him to this day. Because they get caught up in what is on TV. "I feel your pain." They catch the act, but they don't pay attention to the deeds. Well, Machiavelli's saying to the ruler, they have to perform. They can't tell the truth if they want to stay in power. And by the way, if they get screwed over, then you must destroy your enemies.
And I know it's just internet gobbledygook, but do a Google search of how many people the Clintons whacked. It's scary. Go against the Clintons, you ended up dead. Machiavelli 101. Now here's the thing. The prince addressed the School of Europe. It was based on allowing the leader to do whatever was necessary to remain in power and, of course, maintain the independence of his people. And again, the scariness is that it is still applied by many leaders today on the situations they have before them. But here's the biggest thing. It does not diagnose the problems. So the prince doesn't go into trying to explain why these things happen. So it's not a preemptive study, but rather it's a reactive study. It's a recognition that in order to survive, a leader must be prepared to do whatever it takes. So, as the old saying goes, desperate times call for desperate measures. If you feel you are going to get destroyed, you can do whatever is necessary. You can lie, cheat, or steal. Because it's the ends that's important. It's the result. It's not how you get there. Desperate times call for desperate measures. Questions? All right. Well, as I've mentioned twice, and I'll mention it a third time, during the times of peace, that's when the bubble was created. That's what allowed the Italian economy to be so strong. But of course, the economy was strong because of politics. But the ripple effect that the politics had on the economy would, first in Italy, transform the nature of society itself. Going back to the fall of Rome, you had the noble class, and then you had everybody else. You had the kings or the dukes or the lords, the people who had the right last names and all the birthrights associated with it. And then you had the commoners.
Because the nobles were given a monopoly over land ownership, that's what trapped the people to be peasants. But in Italy, because of the trade, because of the mercantilism, because so much wealth was pouring into the peninsula,
a new class appeared. An upper middle class, which the French refer to as the bourgeoisie.
The bourgeoisie is the business class. So this is the class that got their position because of business, not because of birth. Business.
Merchants. Bankers, businessmen. For the first time, again, since the fall of Rome, started doing things that no one else on the continent was doing. They were getting this stuff. Money.
They were getting money without having to own land. They were getting money without having to
feed or protect a labor supply. They were getting real disposable cash. Nana, you wanted my money. What would you do with it if I gave you the money?
There you go, you would spend it. Exactly. If you are poor, if you're a peasant, you have no money. You must work to survive. If you are a noble, you have all those workers doing the work for you. But if you start making money, then you start having the ability to challenge the nobles in terms of power. Because you have the one thing that the nobles don't have, disposable income.
The nobles' wealth is all tied up in property and peasants. So these Italian businessmen soon impacted politics. And again, the example that I gave you on the video were the Medici.
They made so much money in the putting out system, they founded the bank that even kings eventually would have to go to get loans.
And as the old saying goes, if you owe me, I control you. Some use their wealth to influence rulers. Some served as advisors. Some served as diplomats. But ultimately, they were all motivated for the same thing. They wanted to get more money so they can get more power. But what do you do with all that money? Like, think of Bill Gates, although he's dead, Steve Jobs. Who's the guy that owns Facebook? Mark Zuckerberg. Think of all the money that they have. What do you do with it?
Well, one of the things that the bourgeois... Yes?
Gates is not dead.
No. Steve Jobs is. Yeah, Steve Jobs. He's the guy who invented the iPhone.
No, Bill Gates, Yeah, he's not dead.
But again, we'll stick on Bill Gates. Bill Gates started off as a college dropout
who basically stole someone's technology to make the first computers.
And with that, he made a ton of money. Just cash. But what does he do with his money now? He tries influence in politics.
Including, he's trying to push a movement to get human beings from stop eating meat. He wants us all to eat bugs. Because bugs are sustainable.
Sorry. It's throwing me out of the way. Well,
If you have money and you start trying to influence society, influencing culture, if you are uncancelable because you have so much money, you have the ability to do so. Well, the problem was, is up until the Renaissance, culture was controlled by the church. Your life was based upon giving your 30% to the church in alms, suffering, being miserable, but going to church so that way you could go to heaven.
Like I think I said on the video. You know, that's the reason why no one was motivated to change things. Because you, chances are, you were illiterate and you were terrified for your eternal soul, so you obeyed the church completely.
Well, the bourgeois, because they had so much money, they decided they wanted to change society. By trying to enjoy the here and now. They started using their money to patron people who would make them nice things. They started paying the salaries of artists, of sculptors, of artisans, to make themselves feel special. But they also patronized building projects to remind the city how wonderful they are.
Because after all you got to do is go to a park and look at a park bench and see if that park bench has a little plaque on it. And chances are, if it does, that little plaque, that bench, was donated by a family. So they kind of want to remind the community how wonderful they are. Look, I care about you. I'm providing you a place to sit. Or you drive by the road and actually I noticed it in Springfield. I never noticed it before. That everywhere there's like a meridian strip or an intersection and there's a chunk of grass, Springfield is now starting to lease those out. So businesses can basically sponsor cutting the grass on that square. Why? Well, the business wants to advertise to let the community know how great they are. Well, these bourgeoisie had so much money they couldn't take it with them. So they started saying, hey, let's make libraries, let's make theaters, let's make books. I'll pay for it all and just put in there how wonderful I am so people will love me. Now, among the two areas they influenced the most was with art in scholarship. We'll do scholarship first. And by the way, your book, I think we're on chapter 3 now, does go a little more into detail of some of the artists and scholars that I'm going to. I'm just going to give you a couple examples. The ones that I read when I was younger. Having the ability to learn how to read and write is a luxury. Again, if you ever sit around and you bitch and moan and groan about how awful the United States is, remember, if you were born here, you have an absolute right to go to school and you will be educated free of charge. K to 12. Very few countries on earth do that. But back during the Renaissance, it was unthinkable. Less than 1% of people were literate. And the vast majority of people who were literate worked for the church. But during the Renaissance, the bourgeois had so much money,
they began hiring people who could read and write to make books and stories and poems. These individuals effectively became known as men of letters. Men of letters. These were scholars who maybe went to school with the intent on working for the church. So they learned how to read and write Latin, but found other opportunities. So they decided not to become priests. They were hired simply to sit around and read and write. So some of them began learning other languages. For instance, maybe they learned Hebrew or they learned ancient Greek because they wanted to show off how intelligent they were. But suddenly, these individuals were the ones who had the ability to read the old books, the books that dated back to ancient times. And as they studied the Hebrew texts or the Greek and Roman classics, they started replicating the ideas found within. They started trying to promote a rebirth of the things that the ancient Greek Romans were writing about. The Greeks or the Romans. I know we don't have classical studies here, but at some universities they have a study in the classics. So you get a degree based on just reading the old books. But if you ever have the ability to go and read some Roman or Greek text, they're fascinating because they were written at this point, you know, 2,000 to 3,000 years ago. But the people back then were focused on proper grammar or on, you know, how to debate, how to be an effective speaker, rhetoric. They also wrote poetry. They recorded their history. They discussed politics. And most importantly, they created philosophy, the study of the human existence. Well, these men of letters were looking around at what was going on in Europe in 13 and 14, 1500, and all there was Jesus and the church. That's it. Don't do this because you're going to go to hell. Do this to go to heaven. Obey the church. Listen to the church. Be fearful of sin. Well, scholars read the ideas of the ancients and sat back and were shocked when they realized, wait, those old dead people were way more intellectually gifted than people alive in my day. And that was shocking. Because I'm sure you were all told, oh, who cares about the old dead white people? They're old and dead. They don't know anything. Until you read their words and you're amazed. So what did these people do? They started writing not about God, not about heaven, not about theology, religious theory, but they started writing about what it was like being a human being. And it would give rise to a school known as humanism. Now here's the thing. These humanists were not just content to summarize or to compare.
but rather they were drawing upon the sources, trying to apply the ideas to modern times and come up with possible solutions to contemporary problems. What does all that mean? They look to the past to try to figure out today's issues. Because that's another amazing thing, like the School of Europe. You go into the past and you can see in a book, in a simplistic form, of how events unfold. And when you become aware of that and you pay attention to what's going on today, you can draw comparisons. Well, we can do that thanks to these men of letters. But it wasn't just about the old books, because these men of letters also realized something, kind of like Wycliffe. What's the point of me writing my thoughts down in Latin when no one reads or writes or speaks Latin other than scholars? So what these men of letters began doing is began popularizing vernaculars. What's a vernacular? Anybody know?
Language.
It's the language. Spoken where? Where is the vernacular language spoken? Just France? Anywhere else? What's the vernacular language of United States America? English. A vernacular is the language of the people. Who spoke Latin in 1500? The scholars, the people in the church. But where, what country did they come from? You know, was there a country that spoke Latin? Were there commoners who spoke Latin? This is why we're going to waste our time writing books in Latin. Wouldn't it make more sense if we write the books in the words of the people? Because what can the people then do? They can read it. And you can share your ideas. So, during the Renaissance, the Romance languages of Europe were formalized. Spanish, French, Portuguese, Italian, they're all based on Latin, but they're all different, they're distinct. So, during this time period, these scholars started making the grammar rules for those languages. But the same thing occurred in England and in Germany. The English, or English in German, actually derived from ancient Germanic languages. But regardless of the language, there were few, if anything, that was written in those languages. But these scholars began to change things. Yes, many of them still wrote in Latin, but they would make multiple copies. So you write a book in Latin for the scholars, but you also write a book in English so people can read it. And ironically, this created a business opportunity. Because the more books that were written in vernacular, the more there was a demand for books by the wealthy bourgeois. But you know how they wrote books in the 13th and the 14th centuries? What?
Scrolls?
Yeah, well, I mean, they actually had books. They'd moved beyond scrolls. But how are scrolls written? Well, yeah, that's how they, but how do you get the words on the paper?
Ink.
The ink. The books? They actually had books. But the books at the time were all handwritten.
They actually had specialized schools called scriptorium, where monks who maybe didn't have a talent for preaching would go and they'd work and they'd literally spend all day, all night, sitting at a desk, handwriting a book. Ever go through Spaceship Earth in Epcot? There's the scene in the Renaissance where there's a couple of monks like sleeping on the job. That scene depicts what I'm talking about. In order to satisfy demand, new technology had to be improved. So you had that trickle-down effect. So maybe you were not literate, but you had a good idea on how to make books quicker.
One of the first technologies was wood carving. So instead of hand drawing each letter, you'd make like stamps for the words.
But of course, the problem with a hand block and you push it down is, you know, if you use too much force, it smudges. If you use not enough force, the ink doesn't take. So while books could be produced cheaper, it was still labor intensive. That was until 1450.
When an inventor by the name of Hans Gutenberg
adapted ideas that he had heard about thanks to the Silk Road, where the Chinese were using these presses with movable type. Well, he worked on it and he worked on it and he worked on it. And by 1450, he developed his first working model. Gutenberg, instead of using carved words, would use carved letters. And then he had a tray where he would arrange all of the letters that were going to be mapped out, forming all of the words on the page. Then he would ink the letters and take a big sheet of paper and press it together, creating not only movable type, but the first means to mass produce books. Because once a page was set up, you could print as many copies of that page as you wanted to. So while you were working on one page, someone else on the shop was in the back working on some of the other pages. So as soon as you were done with this tray, you bring the next tray over and you continue. Now at first, like any new technology, it was kind of laughable. He made calendars, he made pamphlets, he printed some poems. But in 1452, a wealthy benefactor said, "Can you make me a Bible?" So he sat down to work. In the matter of months, in 1452, he printed 180 copies of what became known as the Gutenberg Bible, which was 1,300 pages long. But it was the first mass-produced book. By the way, of those 180 copies, 21 are still in existence. I think one of them sold at auction. It was like $500 million about 10 years ago. Or maybe not that much. But it's crazy. But here's the lesson in Gutenberg.
You got an idea. You got to come up with a new technology. What should you do? You should patent it. Why?
So people don't copy it.
Yeah. So you can sue them. Well, unfortunately for Gutenberg, there were no patent laws back then. So the moment people heard what he was doing, the first thing they did is they rushed out and they made their own versions.
So within two decades, there were printing houses all across Europe, and poor Gutenberg died penniless. Lessons of business. Questions? All right, what were some of the works that would be mass produced? Well, one of the first books
that would be mass-produced and circulated
would actually be published with printing presses posthumously after he died because of the demand. Because during the early 14th century, a Renaissance writer, Dante Alighieri, would produce a work that embodied the qualities of the ideas of the Middle Ages. This major work is the Divine Comedy. Any of you ever read the Divine Comedy? I think it's Amazon Prime. I think it was a Japanese animation company did a manga, I think that's what they call it, manga, the Japanese cartoon art version of Dante's Inferno. It's pretty good. It basically tells the story, although of course it's more graphic and than the actual story, but if you're interested, you can watch a cartoon of it. But the Divine Comedy, it was written to be a poem. And it tells the story of Dante's alter ego, a man who he called the Pilgrim. And the Pilgrim was on a journey into the afterlife. And what the Divine Comedy did was create, for secular culture, the mental imagery of the afterlife. And they are details today that are imprinted in the public consciousness. The afterlife is divided into three sections. Obviously, paradiso, paradise, or heaven. But there's also a place called purgatorio, purgatory, where the dead go for a short period of time to make up for some of the sins before they can get into paradiso. But there is also the one place you don't want to go, the inferno, hell. And banishment in hell is forever. This book tells the reader how you will end up in each section by talking about historical figures which everyone in the 14th century knew at that time period. And it talks about both the good and the bad that these people did, which resulted in the consequence. Now, of the three books, the most graphic and the one that most people read if you ever have a literature class is The Inferno, because it describes hell. And by the way, Dante's description of hell is still what most people think of when they think of hell. Dante tells us that hell is divided into nine separate circles, or nine realms. And the rings are ordered based upon degree. So, the less significant sins you create or you do in life, you will end up in one of the upper levels. The more significant sin, the closer to Lucifer himself you will end up. Crap, can I do this in 5 minutes? I gotta be quick. All right, here we go. The top layer is referred to as limbo. Limbo. Limbo is reserved for the people who are virtuous. So they're good people. They didn't commit sins.
but they're ignorant of Christ.
So, you're not bad, you just don't believe in Jesus. So if you're an atheist, you're going to limbo. Who does he put down there? Well, again, we don't have to remember these people. But Adam, as in Adam and Eve, is down there. Because after all, he ate the forbidden fruit. Abel, Abraham, Moses, King David, Homer, Julius Caesar. Heck, he even put Salah Adin in there. Plato, Socrates, Cicero, etc., etc. Can't answer your phone. Leave me alone. You know I'm in class. So, yes, they all committed bad things, but in Dante's metrics, they're only there because no Jesus. Second ring, lust. So one is limbo. Second ring is lust. These are the people who think with one's naughty bits as opposed to one's cranial region. So, sexual appetites is what got them there. So someone like Helena Troy, you know, who betrayed her husband and started the Trojan War. Cleopatra is there. Again, who brought down, tried bringing down Caesar, but also brought down Mark Antony with her. Shaking. Achilles is there. Paris. So basically, you go and you get tortured along the lines of the lust that you engaged in. So for instance, if you commit sodomy, you're going to be spending an eternity being sodomized because the punishments are based on the sin. Third, gluttony. Well, gluttony are the people who get both literally and proverbially fat. Usually the people that consume too much, that don't share, that are selfish, gluttony. Fourth ring, greed. Those who like material goods. The people that focus on the bling. Again, as opposed to just being a decent person. I gotta do this quick because we're almost out of time. Five is wrath. People who end up in the fifth ring are banished because they did things based on anger or out of the need for revenge. So we got limbo, lust, gluttony, greed, wrath. Sixth, heresy. Heresy. You commit a crime or commit an act that contradicts Scripture. Joan of Arc, claiming that she heard from the angels, banished to that level of hell. Seven, violence. These are people who commit acts of violence against their neighbors or themselves. So, we're not only talking about violent people like Alexander the Great or Attila the Hun or Genghis Khan. We're also talking about prostitutes who sell their bodies out for money. That's an act of violence against themselves. Or people who commit suicide. Banished to the seventh level of hell. Eight, fraud. We all know what a fraud is, right? What's fraud? Yeah. Claiming you're somebody and then getting some type of gain for it. That's a fraud. Basically lying. So who's down there? Well, politicians, sorcerers, fortune tellers, people who just like creating chaos. They'll be banned down to the eighth level of hell. Oh, you know who's down there? I love this. Not only is Caiaphas, the high priest, who basically conspired with Pontius Pilate to get Jesus crucified, but also the prophet Muhammad is banished to the eighth level of hell. because Mohammed refused to acknowledge Jesus as the Son of God. Last but not least,
treachery, traitors. The most famous person stuck on the ninth level is Judas himself. You know what the punishment for treason is? You are within arm's reach of Lucifer, and every single day he grabs you and consumes you and crunches you up in his belly. But that happens day after day after day. Last thought, I know I'm out of time. Words impact people. These people read the words and it shaped their opinions, and it still does today.
We're going to come back, we're going to finish up with some writers, we'll deal with a couple of artists, and then we'll go on to the Age of Exploration, I think, is next. So, if you are so inclined, you might want to begin the next round of extra credit. And you, sir, are the one who didn't take the test. You're going to have to send me an email. All right? We'll see you. Seriously, why are you texting? Hello? Hi, Nick. How are you? Unfortunately, I am not. I saw the text and I'm not able to take it. I'm going to be going out of the state for the weekend. All right, sorry. Yep, bye. See, every now and then there's money that's not worth it. I'm not going to Boston at 6 o'clock at night on a Friday evening. Nope, nope, nope.